Chapter 3. The Recruiter. The woman chanted softly, her eyes closed. She dipped her fingers into the small bowl Ambergris had given her and pulled them forth dripping with ogre's blood. Gently she stroked the black leather belt, singing to it, the blood streaking it and melting in, disappearing without a trace. Over and over she dipped and ran her bloodied fingers across the enchanted material. This item was for her beloved husband, a secret gift, and one she hoped would keep him alive. A long time later, Catibree collapsed on the floor in exhaustion, the belt still hanging from the rack where she had imbued it with its powers. The mithril buckle glistened in the torchlight. The woman slept the night away, her creation above her. The next day, Catibree wore her simple white robe and a black lace shawl, its loose hood upon her head framing her face. She sat on the altar stone in the primordial chamber and stared up at the water pouring in from the tendrils above, living water, carrying the essence of the elemental plane of water in the form of elementals to hold back the mighty primordial from the plane of fire. These were the roots of the distant host tower of the arcane, the residual magic holding strong for now. The constant steam in the room felt wonderful, and she inhaled it deeply, feeling rejuvenated after the powerful enchanting the day before. There was a great equilibrium to be found here, a profound reminder to her of the balance of Toril itself, the give and take of the seasons, the undulations of the tides. What a wonderful gift was this home, this world. And what a wonderful creation was Gontalgrim. Built by dwarves and almost surely by elves. What other race could have powers great enough to forge the host tower of the arcane and devise this elaborate subterranean aqueduct, enchanting the water with the stuff of that elemental plane all along its 100-mile journey to this place? She could not hope to replicate such a masterpiece, of course, even with the help of Archmage Gromph and the Harples, and any and every other wizard or priestess they might pull in from thousands of leagues around. Magic was no longer as pure as in the long-lost days of Faerûn, and ancient secrets were deeply hidden from the folk of the modern world. But Catibree didn't have to replicate the grandeur of the undertaking that had made Gontalgrim possible, she reminded herself. She just had to repair it. "Give me the wisdom, goddess," she whispered. Someone cleared his throat behind her, and the woman twisted around. Jarlaxle was into his respectful bow before she fully recognized him.
"Again?" she asked in disbelief. "How long have you been there?"
"You looked serious," he said. "I did not want to disturb you."
"But now you have."
The drow mercenary laughed and bowed again. Catibree apologized.
"The task before me is daunting," she admitted.
"We'll find you allies in the undertaking," Jarlaxle promised. "Do not underestimate the knowledge and power of Archmage Gromph. And the Harples, for all their eccentricity, have been known to deliver well in those moments of dire need. And there are others."
"Do tell."
"A thousand dwarves."
"Masons. That's the easy part, even for a structure as beautiful and intricate as the former host tower."
"There are many who would not wish to see the primordial escape its bindings," the drow replied. "And I speak not of fools like Lord Neverember or any other of the local nobles who cannot see far enough past their own mirror to even realize there is a wider world out there."
"More drow?"
"There are a few I would welcome," Jarlaxle replied without hesitation. "And with House Orlaren wandering about, there are some fine wizards to be found to lend a hand. House Orlaren plans to retake Gontalgrim in the distant future, of course, and so they will be most eager to help with keeping the beast in its pit."
"Fine allies," the woman said dryly.
"Common goals, for now." Catibree heaved a sigh, shook her head, and faced the pouring water again. But no, I wasn't speaking of drow, Jarlaxle said, walking over to stand beside her. We already have the most learned of all the drow wizards in the person of Gromf. But there are others with knowledge of the ancient ways and magic. We will find them. He put his hand comfortingly on Catibree's shoulder, and she turned her head to regard him. She even managed a slight hopeful nod at his welcomed optimism. Truly, this was a daunting task. You will find these others, then, as we go about our work.
I hope. It is not in my best interest to let Gauntlegrim fall to the primordial, even beyond my friendship.
He paused and let that hang for a moment, staring hard at the woman.
Is that the appropriate word? He asked at length. Am I considered a friend to the companions of the hall? To King Brunner of Gauntlegrim?
You know the answer to that.
But I want to hear it from you, he said. And of you. Am I your friend, Catibree?
The woman put her hand up to cover Jarlaxle's, but turned back to watch the waterfall. You perplex me, she admitted. I am never quite sure of your motives or your goals, and yet, those have aligned with my own enough times now that I have come to trust you.
As a friend?
Yes. She was surprised by her quick admission, but even in reflection, she couldn't deny that she did indeed consider Jarlaxle a friend. He always had ulterior motives, of course, but he had never given Catibree or any of them any reason to believe that he would betray them. She remembered that day long, long ago, when she, Drizzt, and Intrary were trying to escape Menzo Berenzon, only to find Jarlaxle and his band waiting for them in the tunnels. He had them caught, but let them go. Certainly Drizzt was fond of the mercenary leader, with caution, of course.
I have a grand stake in the matter of King Brunner remaining in control of this wondrous place, Jarlaxle said with a smile. I will endeavor to make sure that the drow of Menzo Berenzon do not try to displace him, and the trading opportunities this arrangement presents for me.
Well, let me just say that I am quite pleased that the dwarves have retaken Gauntlegrim. Now Catibree looked at the mercenary a bit more cautiously. Jarlaxle was ever the opportunist. Could he really facilitate the movement of goods from Menzo Berenzon on the surface through Gauntlegrim? Menzo Berenzon and Mithril Hall had been mortal enemies. Indeed, was it not Menzo Berenzon that had spurred the most recent war in the Silver Marches? It was King Brunner himself who had cleaved the head of Matron Mother Baenri in the time of troubles, cementing their enmity. She stared at Jarlaxle for a long while, and finally understood that he really was thinking of such possibilities. In the end, she just shook her head. If anyone could accomplish such a ridiculously improbable thing, it would be Jarlaxle.
Where is my husband? She asked, thinking it time to change the subject. And why had Jarlaxle come here to see her?
I was told he is patrolling the lower tunnels, as the dwarves attempt to widen their borders.
Catibree nodded. That fit her expectations, though she hadn't seen Drizzt since they'd split up earlier that morning.
There are no Zor-Larans out there to concern you, Jarlaxle added.
You have seen to that?
To some extent, yes. Let us just say that I showed them a better opportunity at this time than some foolish attempt to retake what King Brunner has secured. I cannot speak for any demons, however. It is my understanding that the Underdark has become thick with the wretched things.
What news, then, of the Host Tower? Catibree asked.
No news, the mercenary replied.
Again, Catibree studied him carefully. And when she found no clues there, Jarlaxle stood quite at ease, she bluntly asked,
Why have you come to this place? There is nothing here that concerns you.
I disagree, good lady. There is plenty here that concerns me greatly.
Me?
If so, then perhaps you should get to the point of your visit.
More than that, Jarl Axel said. And he walked over to the edge of the primordial pit, staring down into the watery swirl and to the fiery eye of the beast below the water elementals.
Perhaps you should stop speaking in cryptic riddles.
Jarl Axel turned to face her. Do you know why Artemis Entreri is still alive? He asked. The question gave Catti Bree pause.
I do not know why I am still alive,
she replied after a few moments.
Why would I know the cause or purpose of that one's existence?
He was cursed, so we all believed, with his life force tied to a most wicked and powerful item.
The sword, yes,
the woman replied.
Drizzt came with him and Dahlia to this very place, so that Entreri could throw the weapon into the pit to be devoured by the primordial,
believing he would also be destroyed.
But he was not, said Catti Bree. So it was not the sword after all.
Unfortunately, I believe it was, said Jarl Axel.
The sword was destroyed,
Catti Bree's declaration caught in her throat, and she walked over to stand next to Jarl Axel. Was it? He asked. Catti Bree looked into the pit, and viewing the orange glow at the bottom, she could keenly feel the insatiable hunger of the great fiery beast. With hardly a thought to the movement, she ran the tips of the thumb and index finger of her right hand over the band she wore on her left.
If not, it is irretrievable in any case, she said. Swallowed by the molten stone that gives the primordial form.
Are you sure? Jarl Axel asked.
What are you proposing?
Have you ventured down there? The drow asked. You have a bond with the great beast, it is clear. It speaks to you through the ring you wear and in the voice of the elemental plane of fire which you understand. So have you gone down there to be near the beast, to better see it, to better know it? Catti Bree balked and stepped back from the ledge, but kept her incredulous stare on Jarl Axel. Down there below the water elementals, she would be at the mercy of the primordial. Whatever protective magic she might don, the mighty creature could still swallow her and force her deep into its molten gullet.
It wouldn't kill you, though, would it? Jarl Axel asked. Not while you wear the ring. You have given the trapped primordial an outlet for its frustrations. It has shown you its secrets and lent you wisps of living flame. It led you to the ancient portal and helped you turn that staff you carry into something more potent.
And perhaps it knows that I am trying to keep it forever sealed in its hole, she retorted.
Jarl Axel shrugged. Perhaps. But how can you remain so near to such beauty and preternatural power and not be curious?
I never said I wasn't curious.
You are not a coward, of that I am certain. Enough of your games, Jarl Axel, the woman demanded. What do you want?
The mercenary drow reached into a belt pouch and pulled out a large gauntlet, one that seemed far too large to have fit in the pouch, which of course must be magical. Was anything on or about Jarl Axel not magical? Catti Bree wondered. He showed it to Catti Bree, then tossed it to her.
This is a sister item to the sword, Karin's Claw, he explained. Necessary protection from the deadly magic of the weapon.
You expect me to go down into that pit and retrieve the sword, which is almost certainly not there?
If it is not there, then at least we will know. And then Entreri can rest easy that his longevity is not tied to the sword.
Catti Bree tossed the gauntlet back.
You are not without magic. Go and get it yourself.
It is Catti Bree who is bonded with the primordial. Catti Bree who understands the beast. Catti Bree who has determined that we must act to keep the volcano dormant, and what that action must be to achieve such an end. It is Catti Bree, not Jarl Axel, who carries a gift from the primordial, and who coaxes elementals from the flames of the beast's tendrils.
And it is Catibri who is wise enough to respect the power of the beast, she said.
Jarlaxle laughed and bowed. There is another reason for my request, I admit, he said, and he tossed the gauntlet back to her as she looked at him curiously. You claim to know the beast. We are all counting upon your judgment to guide us to a solution for the future dangers you have foretold. But how certain of you of what you have determined? How well do you really know this creature, this living volcano? You have met its offspring and touched its outer edges, but you have not faced it directly. I have spoken to Archmage Gromp about this, and we are in agreement. You should face the primordial directly. You should stand before it and let it reveal to you more of its secrets. It may be our only hope in reconstructing the magic that will keep it in place.
Catibri fumbled over her thoughts in light of the dramatic request. And if I reveal to it my own intentions, she asked, will this great and ancient beast not merely consume me and be done with it? Surely the primordial desires release.
We cannot know what such a creature desires, Jarlaxle said.
Catibri had to concede that point. This was not a creature of similar mind to any living being walking the ways of Faerun. This was an ancient, devouring magic whose goals were unknown and perhaps unknowable to a human or a drow.
Perhaps there are other ways the beast might find that release, Jarlaxle offered. Ways less devastating than a volcanic eruption. Ways that afford us all, even the beast, what we desire.
And you are a chosen of Mieliki.
You would understand such a natural catastrophe as a primordial of fire better than perhaps any other god. Surely you can use that discipline and standing to direct the conversation with the primordial in a manner of your own choosing.
Catibri held up the gauntlet. And since I will be down there anyway, she said dryly.
I would be forever grateful, Jarlaxle said. Indeed, I will make it worth your while many times over.
I am the daughter of a dwarven king, she reminded him. Your riches do not interest me.
Jarlaxle's smile said otherwise. I do not speak idly, my good lady. It is a small thing I ask of you, and that in accord with a short journey that may well help us all.
Catibri looked down, her expression doubtful. Even with her magical ring, she could feel the heat of the primordial's fiery breath. But still she began to cast a spell, using her divine powers to protect her even more from the heat and the flames. How am I to even get down there? Where am I to stand in a sea of liquid stone?
She turned back to Jarlaxle as she asked the second question, to find the mercenary holding out to her some black cloth, a folded garment, perhaps.
Catibri looked at it, then at Jarlaxle for just a moment, then took it and unfolded it to find a shimmering black cape with a high, stiff collar.
This was worn by Kensadan, who was once long ago called High Captain Kurth. It passed from him to his descendants, to Dahlia, surprisingly. Drizzt knows this cloak. Put it on. You will understand.
The woman swept the cloak around her back and found the ties.
It perfectly complements your outfit, Jarlaxle said with a nod of approval. So beautiful.
A statement of fashion? She asked skeptically.
Much more than that, he replied. Let it speak to you.
With a final doubtful look at Jarlaxle, Catibri closed her eyes and let her thoughts drift to the cloak. Like so many magical items, this garment, the cloak of the crow, seemed to want its wearer to understand its properties. It was one of the more curious aspects of magic, Catibri often thought, that even the insentient magical items wanted their magic to be used. She let her thoughts reach deeper into the cloak,
and lifted her arms out wide, to find that they were not arms any longer, but shining black-feathered wings. She could feel the updrafts of heat from the pit more acutely then, playing among her feathers. So sure was she that she didn't question Jarlaxle further, nor did she cast any contingency spells in case the cloak should fail. She just leaned forward and let the updrafts lift her from the ground. Down went the giant crow, cutting tight circles within the encircling and swirling dance of the water elementals. Even with her ring and the additional spells, Catti Bree could feel the heat growing as she neared the bottom of that watery barricade. She broke through, under the wetness and the mist, and it seemed to her as if she had gone to another plane of existence, or another world perhaps, or to Toril in the earliest days of its formation. Yes, that was it, she somehow understood. This molten field of bubbling magma and powerful stench, she felt as if she had been thrown into a boiling cauldron of rotten eggs. This was the way the world had been in the earliest days, before the elves even, perhaps before all life on Toril. She drifted in the orange glow for just a moment, before spotting and then landing on a solid block of veined stone. She touched down tentatively, ready to fly away if the stone proved too hot for her multiple duiarmors of protection to counter. But to her relief, she felt no burning pain. With a thought and a shrug, Catti Bree came out of crow form and paused a moment to ponder her earliest days in this second life she had found, when the spell scar of Mialiki had granted to her shape-shifting powers. How often had she flown over the plains of Netheril in the shape of a great bird? How free she had been on the updrafts with the world spread wide below her? All those thoughts blew away on a hot breeze when the primordial's voice came into her thoughts, seeping through her ring. She sensed the creature's confusion, dangerous confusion, and so she answered back in the language of the plane of fire, whispering assurances and seeking common benefit. The primordial responded to her with sensations. She felt the beast stretching its tendrils to the forge, to the inactive portal, to the spouts she had found when they had retaken the complex, like the lava mound where Catti Bree had transformed her staff. On impulse, she banged her staff on the stone, shifting it to its fiery form. She felt the pleasure of the primordial. Then she began to probe. She looked up and focused on the water elementals, and she felt the primordial's frustration and anger. But it was not as burning an anger as she had imagined. And she was glad. Perhaps there were ways to lessen the preternatural desires of the beast, ways to siphon off some of its explosive and deadly energy. For a long time, Catti Bree stood there in communion with the primordial, viewing Gontalgrim from its perspective, and in that mental bonding, she gained some insights into the magic that had put the beast in the pit and kept it there. Insights she knew would aid her in the repair of the host tower of the Arcane. She did well to keep those thoughts properly suppressed. If the primordial so desired, she would be dead, buried in lava and burned to nothingness long before she could get near to the protection of the water elementals. But the primordial wasn't going to do that. It seemed to her that the beast almost enjoyed the company. No, that wasn't it. Creatures like this didn't harbor such emotions. But still, there was no displeasure revealed. Clearly, the beast understood that it was in control and that she was no threat, and so it tolerated her. It accepted the diversion with some modicum of pleasurable distraction. On recognizing that, Catti Bree would have liked to remain. But the thought was accompanied by a stumble, a near swoon that would have dropped her into the lava. It wasn't the heat, but the smell, the lack of breathable air. She knew then that she had to be attentive to her task and quickly away. She put the gauntlet on her hand and held it out in display to her godlike host. She didn't know whether it was the gauntlet or the beast, but she sensed something not so far away. Becoming a crow again, she fluttered over to another mound of stone, quickly reverting to her human form. She stared down into the bubbling, popping red magma. Dare she reach in? The woman shook her head before her hand even moved, certain that the molten stone would incinerate the glove and her hand, whatever enchantments she might try. But still she stared, leaning low, mesmerized by the bubbling red lava. And something substantial came forth, rising up from the magma. Caterbury recoiled, taken aback by what appeared to be the skull and bleached bones of a small humanoid skeleton, a backbone and ribcage to a pelvis, with bony legs spread wide to either side. The item rose a bit more, bobbing in the heavy liquid, and Caterbury gasped as she realized this to be the hilt and crosspiece of a sword, the slender etched blade shining red in the glow of the lava. With her gauntleted hand, she grasped the backbone hilt inside the basket of the ribcage and drew forth the sword, holding it up in front of her astonished eyes. She felt the power of Karin's claw. She felt its wickedness and had to work hard to resist the urge to throw it back into the magma. The molten power of the primordial had not eaten Karin's claw, had marred that perfect blade not at all. Caterbury called upon the cloak again and shifted to the crow. With a cursory telepathic salute to the primordial, she lifted away, beating her strong wings to circle once more inside the elemental swirl. Rising, she broke through on the other side and lit on the ledge near the sarcophagus stone. Jarlaxle was patiently waiting for her there.
"I knew it," he said, his eyes sparkling when Caterbury reverted to her human form, revealing the treasure she held in her gauntleted hand. The woman examined the sword again and realized it wasn't the lava that had given Karin's claw its red hue. The blade itself was red, with a black blood trough running down the center. She marveled at the workmanship, at the masterful etchings of hooded figures and tall scythes all along the blade. "It has few equals in the world," Jarlaxle said, startling her. She looked over at the mercenary. "A most remarkable blade," he said.
"And full of evil intent," she replied.
"A thirst for blood," he admitted. "Is that not the purpose of a weapon?"
"There is a power here."
She shook her head, nearly overwhelmed. She had once wielded Kazidea, the blade that now hung on Jarlaxle's belt, but even that marvelous weapon of destruction seemed to pale beside the wicked magnificence of this creation.
"Weapons are designed to kill, my good lady." Jarlaxle motioned to the floor and pointed to the gauntlet. "Do not touch the sword without it," he warned.
Caterbury set the sword on the stone and pulled off the gauntlet, handing it over. As Jarlaxle set it upon his hand, the woman moved to remove the cloak, but Jarlaxle held up his hands and shook his head.
"My gift to you," he said.
Caterbury nodded.
"A worthwhile trade, then?"
"Oh, it is no trade," he replied. "The cloak is my gift to you. Your reward for the sword is yet to come, and I promise you it is a far greater gift."
He picked up the sword and saluted Caterbury with it, then smiled, bowed, and turned, moving back to the tunnel to the forge. Caterbury considered him for a long while, but did not follow. She found herself at the ledge once more, looking down into the pit, past the watery swirl, to the fiery eye. The beast had allowed her into its presence and had not consumed her. Strangely, she felt blessed, and Caterbury knew she would return to the bottom of this pit again, perhaps many times.